You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya,
Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustayo. Okay, let's see here.
You're listening live to the seventh episode of the Arman and Akil show, bringing you interviews with local activists, politicians, and policy experts from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. But sometimes just shows where we talk, play clips, and react to them, like today. I'm Arman Rana.
And I'm Akil Krishnan. It's Saturday, the 12th of August, 2023, at 5:07 p.m. We are broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
How does it feel back, Akil? How does it feel to be back, I guess?
Has it been 3 months?
It's been 3 months while you were slacking off in India, going to the Washington State to watch soccer games.
A month in India, yeah. A trip to Seattle to watch a baseball game. Yeah,
I did. Oh, it was a baseball
game. There was also an ultra marathon somewhere in there. It feels good. It feels good to be back. I think I missed it, but I didn't realize I missed it until I got here. And yeah. We're here on air and we're talking. I really missed this. I feel like I'm a fish back in water now.
Yeah, yeah.
How is you've had some interesting experiences in the meantime because you posted two shows on your own. And how was your trip to Banff?
Yeah, it was great. Our way back was unfortunately marred by forest fires, so really sad to see a lot of forest burnt up. We ended up spending some time in a place called Greenwood. It's actually Canada's smallest city. Its entire population is, guess.
It's a small city. I want to say 6,000.
700.
Tell me that's a hamlet.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a town. It's actually a city. It's got a mayor. We're going to hear from in a moment. But it really, you know, it really helps put your life in perspective where you see people living, you know, full and complete lives, enjoying them. There's a nice Mexican place where this elderly couple seemed to be serving lunch to basically the entire city. It was really amazing. So I'm just going to start us off by playing a little clip from the mayor of the city. I think it's a year old, announcing their...
A mayor of this incredibly large-hearted city.
Large-hearted, yeah, is the correct term. Let's just wait for this freedom and to end.
In the 1800s, the city has seen many different resurgences. First, it was the Wild Wild West, where people moved to strike it rich, looking for gold, silver, and copper. And today, its claim to fame is that it's Canada's smallest city, with the population of only 727 people. Now the city is celebrating its 125th birthday, while honoring the sizable role it played in Canada's development.
It was mining and smelting, and it lasted until 1918, when after the First World War, copper prices collapsed, and so that was the end of the smelter here in Greenwood. The mining depleted quite significantly, so Greenwood's population dwindled down to closely around 200 people.
That's when Greenwood became part of a dark chapter in Canada's history. The small city is also marking 80 years as the first internment community in the province.
After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there was a forced internment of the Japanese Canadians off the West Coast. There were 1,200 Japanese that came here. Greenwood had a lot of old hotels and large buildings, and so those buildings were converted to crude living conditions.
When you look around town, it's obvious that the city has deep roots. Proof of that isn't hard to find. Main Street is filled with grand structures. The city has now become a popular tourist spot because of it.
We probably have the most wood-based standing buildings from the turn of the century.
That's the mayor.
Our Main
speaking.
Street buildings are all still original from the era, and a lot of the homes are still some of the original architecture.
Off the beaten path, you need to know where to look. like the old courthouse. That is also City Hall, and in the basement there's jail cells, a wooden one for women and an iron one for men. It's no longer used today. However, Mayor Noel is optimistic that Greenwood has a bright future ahead.
Well, you know, there's always ore in the hills. It hasn't gone. They didn't get it all out. You never know what'll happen in the future. It may become a mining area again. Currently, it's forestry. You know, 100 years from now, who's to know? But its air is fresh and the water is the very best, so this is the place to be.
There's plenty of events going on in town.
I just love that part where he says this is the place to be. It just really puts you...
Well, you've got to have some claim to fame. You either got to be the biggest, the brightest city, or you're the smallest city, you know. Something that still keeps you memorable. Would you agree with the assessment that there's a very bright future?
I don't know about that, but he's a very bright present. Like, people seem very happy there and enjoying life. It was pretty cool.
Did you sample anything else besides the... Did you sample anything, any other Greenwood sites besides the Mexican restaurant?
Not really. There was this Deadwood jail that we were kind of lurking around, but we didn't get very close to it. But it was right next to the Mexican restaurant.
Oh.
So we didn't know if it was a real jail or it was just...
It's such a small city that there's just a jail.
Yeah.
And there's a restaurant next to it. And it's just all part of Main Street.
Yeah, and then there were people sitting in like the... just in front of the jail and eating their Mexican food. It was kind of interesting.
Well, sometimes you want a change of scenery, you know. You just want to eat your food, eat your lunch in front of a possibly functioning jail.
Yeah, yeah. Initially, I thought, oh, there's inmates or something. But I just saw people walking over between the two. And I was like, yeah, I wasn't sure. Speaking of...
So, you know, while we were... While we were preparing for this show, we thought we'd touch upon the Barbenheimer phenomenon. But then we'd realized that we hadn't watched the Barbie movie. I don't think you've watched the Oppenheimer movie yet, have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay, but I watched Oppenheimer last weekend on 70mm IMAX. It's an experience. So we figured that we'd at least... we both had to have at least watched one of them. So we decided to watch the Barbie movie a couple of hours ago.
Yeah, it's a totally rational, normal decision-making process when you're preparing for a show.
When you're working on a script and you just stop working on the script and you say, hey, we've got a couple hours for the show. Do you want to go watch the Barbie movie?
Yeah, yeah, and dress up in pink. Yeah, let's do that.
Having watched the movie, what's your take on it?
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, I think what I was left with, it was so self-aware and... yet such an effective, you know, marketing for, I guess, Barbie merchandise. At the same time, like, very self-aware and self-critical and self-almost deprecating of the company Mattel, which runs Barbie. So,
yeah,
you know, that was the fascinating. And it was just a really fun movie and entertaining movie.
And
the dialogue was really sharp.
It was. And it was self-deprecating, the characters that formed the leadership of Mattel in the movie were quite self-deprecating to their real-life counterparts, that's very interesting. I don't see this movie has been likened to the first Marvel movies, which kind of started this entire universe for Marvel and which is now Disney. But I don't see, like, a Marvel movie that has, like, a caricature of Bob Iger on there.
Yeah, that's what we need to refresh the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We just need Bob Iger to show up in the new, I don't know, what's it called, Thor 500?
Love and Mystery, whatever the new one is.
The new one, it should be called Love and Bob Iger.
Love and Bob Iger's Endless Optimism.
Yeah. But it was quite interesting. What else did you like about? What was your take on it?
I love the obsession with the Ken's obsession with horses.
Yeah, yeah. So Ryan Gosling plays one of the Kens, and he's just.
So for those of you who haven't watched the movie, they end up spoiler alert, they end up in the real world, and they he
encounters horses for the first time, and he's completely taken by them.
Yeah, yeah. He also, so he simultaneously encounters patriarchy and kind of fuses the two together.
Exactly.
It's actually the most endearing vision of patriarchy that I've encountered in my life, which is not, I think, a descriptor that one typically attaches to patriarchy.
No, I think it's hard to take a whimsical view of patriarchy when you're when it's been impacting every bit of your life. But in the real world, but if you come from somewhere where the patriarchy doesn't exist, then absolutely you have to deal with it with some whimsy.
Yeah, yeah.
I also liked the fact that the entire movie had like this. The entire movie was about the interaction between this imaginary place and the real world, and just how disappointing it would be for. What the impression of Barbie's effect is, as opposed to what it, the impression of what it actually, what effect it actually had.
Yeah, yeah. I think the message was there were many messages in the movie, but it was quite a very interesting movie for the makers of Barbie to push out there. It was very effective. Where the movie ended as well was a very interesting place as well.
Yeah.
And just the dialogue. There's just so many tiny moments. I probably only got like one third of the references.
Yeah.
And even then, I probably got more than,
than
I think half of our audience who was, some of whom were like under 10.
Yeah.
But it was just, there's so many references. There was this Spanish thrown in that we Googled later, and
there was a real life Ken who wasn't explicitly said to be Ken, but he was very much a Ken who uses the Spanish at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
But also, I just, one that really stuck out to me is when Barbie gets called a fascist.
that's sort of the highlights of the film. By one of the protagonists of the film, just straight up, just like calls Barbie a fascist. How would you compare it to Oppenheimer?
To Oppenheimer, the other half of that. Yeah, it was basically the same movie with different actors.
Not worth seeing both of them, right?
No. It's you know the cinematography is really good, but it's basically the same story. Yeah. Oppenheimer was really good. I loved the cinematic value of the movie, the shots, some of the sets, they were just incredible to just see, especially in 70mm IMAX, because it gives you the entire vision of Christopher Nolan as he wanted to show it, and none of it's kind of cut off, or the aspect ratio allows for you to see everything. If you already knew the story, I think you still might find that there were parts of it that you maybe didn't know as well, or parts that you didn't fully appreciate. And it's an interesting movie. And I think they tried their best to capture how tortured Oppenheimer was by his role in developing a nuclear weapon. And there's a cameo by Truman. And if you know anything about Harry Truman, that cameo by Gary Oldman perfectly encapsulates how Truman was as a person and as president. But I think I would recommend watching it.
Well, if you had to pick one that somebody would watch, which one would it be?
I think it's all down to taste. If you are a student of history like myself, you would particularly like Oppenheimer. And if you're somebody who loves watching movies for the more technical aspects of filmmaking, you would really like Oppenheimer. So it's just down to taste.
I see.
If you like wearing pink like I do, then maybe Barbie's the movie for you.
You seem very confused about which one you would prefer. Continuing on the theme of, you know, women being just generally more effective and more competent leading, which was one of the messages of the Barbie movie, at least for Barbie Land. Well, it seems that applies to the real world as well. because we have Pierre Polyev's latest campaign ad, which heavily features his wife, Anna Polyev, for some reason. Let's take a listen.
Interesting timing that this ad was released shortly after the separation announcement was announced by Trudeau's Justin Trudeau's spokesperson.
Yeah, yeah, very, very sketchy stuff going on there.
Who is Pierre Polyev? Many know him as the common sense leader the country needs. His schoolteacher parents know him as the boy they adopted and raised in their modest home in the suburbs of Calgary. His dad knows him as the son he took to early morning hockey games. His neighbors know him as the boy who used to deliver the morning newspaper. His children know him in Français, Espanol, and English as Papa. And I know him as a guy who loves me for who I am, a Canadian who came to call Canada home, and his wife. So when Pierre says, it doesn't matter who you know or where you're from, but rather who you are and where you're going, these aren't just empty words. He's lived it. Common sense. Let's bring it home.
Yeah, initial reaction to hearing that ad?
Anna Polyev is an incredibly effective speaker. She's somebody that she made me feel things as someone who's in the audience of a political speech, right? I've seen her speak at the leadership conference.
Yeah, that speech was really powerful.
Really powerful, and it made, you know, as a someone in the audience of a political speech, you want to feel things, right? That's the hallmark of a great speech, and she definitely captures her audience in that way. She's a really good orator.
Yeah, and the contrast is amazing between
The contrast is like leagues apart between what Anna Polyev can do and what the leader and possible future prime minister of the country,
likely future prime minister based on current polling,
yeah, can do. Which Pierre Polyev just doesn't speak as effectively as she does. I don't know. His monotone isn't really as appealing to me.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're discussing before the show. You know, I think. This is more kind of like a public speaker, just in terms of style, that, you know, you feel moved by it to try and something you want to get behind, some positive vision.
Right.
Vis-a-vis, I think Pierre Polyev makes you want to, you know, break something, or I don't know. It's kind of
I likened Pierre Polyev speaking. He makes you feel like how you look in a passport photo.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, some Canadians do feel that way right now.
Absolutely.
And that's a valid feeling. Yeah. But he just brings out that particular emotion, not necessarily a very positive one.
Right. But I think the point I'm driving at is, if you played me a clip of Anna Polyev and Pierre Polyev, and you said, who do you think is running to be prime minister? I would immediately say Anna Polyev.
So let's play Pierre Polyev. He has this tendency just before our show to launch this very specific appeal to the Indian community. A couple of months ago, in May, he launched this appeal about how we all need to be flying to Amritsar. You should check out a show about that.
On direct flights,
direct
by the way.
Direct flights. And then this one is called Batting to Restore Hope in Canada. Batting, he's referring specifically to batting in cricket. So let's play a bit of his statements and then talk a little. I'll describe a bit.
Our leader, our family man, the next Prime Minister of Canada, Bill
Thank you very much to the great Tim McFall, a champion of cricket, a champion of the Conservative Party, and a great personal friend of mine who helped me win the leadership and who's working hard to bring about a government that works for the people rather than working against the people.
Yeah, so he goes on to talk at length, but I think that the real highlight of this video, which unfortunately we will just describe to you, is he does some, he gets into the game of cricket as well with our friend Tim Iqbal. And how would you describe his batting style, Akil?
To put it simply, imagine for those of you who are familiar with cricket, imagine you are batting and you suddenly play a Serena Williams forehand.
Yeah, it's similar. You hold a bat in cricket, similar almost to golf initially.
Exactly. Yes. And it's perfect. It's like you're playing. It's similar to playing like a golf shot, except the ball's moving towards you as opposed to stationary on the ground. But yeah, he definitely switched sports in the middle there.
It was a very elegant forehand, you know, and it did the job in the moment. And then the clip of it, the kind of the thumbnail is. Him saluting the crowd with his cricket bat, which is a gesture you typically make after scoring like a significant amount of
handsome number of runs. Yeah. Like, say a 50 or 100.
It's equivalent to like a home run or something.
Exactly. Yes.
In baseball. So yeah, it's you know, it's just I just love.
It's an interesting patchwork.
I just love Pierre Polyev's love for our community. Hmm. It warms my heart. Just to see us get, like, I love cricket and to see what's the word.
It's great to see Canadian politicians reach out to like minority communities.
Reach out to my minority community of cricket players. Like the cricket, old one, I don't want to go to Amritsar.
Cricket loving Canadian Indians.
Yeah, I don't want to go to Amritsar, but this really hits the spot. He just needs to work on his technique a bit.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And yeah, and then you know, just the minor issues around his tax policy, but
you know, I want to see Justin Trudeau and Jagmeet Singh on a field, either bowling or fielding or do something. Yeah, you know, I just want
to
see them.
Yeah, that's next. They have to do it. He's raised the stakes. He's raised it. Like now, the bar is you have to swing a cricket bat. So now Jagmeet, he's actually somewhat Indian.
Yeah.
So he needs to like. Be hitting sixes, you know.
Exactly,
he needs to be like playing full-on games now, like test matches or something. I don't know.
And Justin
at least
Trudeau,
a T20 game,
right? Exactly. And Justin Trudeau, who's not from the community,
needs it even more.
Yeah. So he needs to what he basically needs to say is he needs to commit that in 2024, in the summer of 2025, we will all be on a direct flight to Amritsar to play a cricket game in the Gandhi Sports Complex in Amritsar.
Yeah. That's it. That's it. Okay. So. On to
Talking about things happening in Ontario, I've been curious to see what our friend Premier of Ontario has been up to. So what's Doug Ford been up to?
Well, he hasn't been playing cricket, which though he is dealing with green belts, which is something that you have in cricket. It's played on a kind of green turf.
For sure.
But he's doing something else with the green belt. He's actually trying to develop it to build somewhat urgently needed housing. Unfortunately for him and maybe Ontario, the kind of the process has kind of been somewhat flawed. Several developers made curiously timed purchases, which enabled them to receive a huge windfall. This is all according to the Auditor General's report, who's kind of recommended that some of these transactions be reversed because it's kind of improper if, you know, some developers got some inside scoop, buy up a bunch of land, and then it's rezoned, right?
I just want to cut in you quickly. What is the Green Belt for some of our listeners
Not familiar? It's a protected area of land. I think it's, you know, thousands of acres of protected area in Ontario. So they're kind of redeveloping about 3,400 acres. I don't know how much that is as a percentage, but it's a significant amount. So let's take a listen to his comments. About that.
The only way to get live Premier League matches is with Fubo TV.
Sorry about that.
Oh, that's not that important.
The previous government changed the green belt 17 times. I'm going to repeat that number. 17 times. And guess why they changed the green belt, my friends? Because they were building mega mansions for their buddy. They were building a golf course, they were building a golf dome, and they're building a Jiffy Loop.
Premier, just to pick up on that point, hasn't the Auditor General's report comprehensively demolished that talking point that you bring up over and over again, the 17 times the Liberals altered the Greenbelt. I covered that when it happened. It was 340 acres. It was mostly administrative changes, transition problems with the boundaries. It is not related in any way to the process you went under, which was 3 weeks. Nobody could apply. There were 600 applications under that process. So first, if you just respond, why do you continue to repeat that utterly demolished talking point? There's no comparison between these two events.
Well, actually, there is. There's one government that changed it 17 times because they knew it was the wrong decision, right? It's very simple. But they did it for two different reasons. I'll finish my question, then you can ask me another one, and the answer, I should say. They went out, which is not being reported, for their buddies, for their mega mansions. They went out to build a golf course. They went out for a golf dome and a Jiffy Lube. We're going out to build homes.
So as well-intentioned as Doug Ford's might be, he's mixing up his questions and answers there. But I didn't actually know what a Jiffy Lube was.
Particular obsession that they rezoned from protected land. Okay, I'm trying to wrap my head around this. Is there any merit? Well, I think one of the journalists in that media pool there called him out on it. But specifically, is there any merit to the story that they rezoned it 17 times, one of those times ostensibly to build a Jiffy Lube?
And now, so I'm quoting from the Toronto Star, of the 17 areas that were removed from the Greenbelt in 2017, so it actually happened once, it wasn't 17 times, none have appeared to have been used for Jiffy Lubes, golf courses, or much else. It's mostly uninhabited, there are a few suburbs, but just in terms of scale of development, just so everybody's eyes on the big picture, the size of rezoning that Doug Ford has undertaken is over 20 times what happened in 2017. So, there's no comparison. That was around 344 acres. This is around, it's about 20 times. This is around 3,400 acres. Mm. So, that was around, under 200 acres. I can't remember the details, right. But it's a significantly larger undertaking this time around.
And the process, from that clip, I gather that the process that they undertook this time was with limited public participation, either in consultation, either on the consultation side of things or in the application or tender side of things.
Yeah. And one thing is the consultation side. Like, okay, I totally get it. You want to rush through housing. If he was rushing through great public housing for lower income people, I'd be like, go do it.
I think we would probably be okay with it, but NIMBYs might not.
Yeah, or even some environmentalists. But like, he's doing this and it's just some sketchy developers have bought up the land ahead of time. And now he's not, like, in the name of housing, he's not reversing certain, some of those transactions, which have been specifically called out by the Auditor General. It's a fascinating situation. Like, several other parts of government are trying to stall him now, which is kind of unfortunate because end of the day, it's just going to contribute more to slowing down the development of new housing because this whole process was
muddled,
allegedly corrupt, right?
By the way, the person alleging this is the Auditor General.
So I'm
inclined to think there are there's significant merit in these allegations.
Yeah, exactly, right? At least we know what a Jiffy Lube is now. It's an American chain of automotive, I guess, lubricant
vehicles. And servicing centers that have a penchant of showing up when rezoning happens, apparently, in the Greenbelt.
According to Doug Ford. Apparently somebody has found a Mr. Lube somewhere just outside the border of the area that was rezoned, and maybe that's what he saw and he got confused. He was just driving around the Greenbelt, as one does.
Of course, yeah. Just like, Doug Ford, Henry Ford. It's just, what's in a name? That's very interesting, yeah. Doug Ford never ceases to surprise me, or appall me, either way, with the stuff he says.
Well, I think it's time for a bit of a break. So thanks so much to our audience for listening. It's the Arman and Akil show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are going through some weird and wonderful clips from last month's news. After the break, we're going to talk about maybe some private jets, a few other things. So do stay tuned.
Nothing goes together better than live music and a beer. Or two. Or five. Wait a minute. An estimated 886,000 Canadians aged 15 and older abused or were dependent on alcohol in 2012. 1 in 7 Canadians aged 15 years and older experience verbal, emotional, and physical abuse as a result of another person's drinking. Make sure a fun night out doesn't ruin everyone else's, or your own. If you see yourself or someone you know slightly off-key, help everyone out and step in. After all, you want to be able to remember the show tomorrow morning.
All right, I'm gonna do it wrong. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know?
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does it make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we... You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival, fountain, just back from France... Montreal? What the f***?
It's a script.
I couldn't even... What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Fountain, back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that. Because even a f***ing elf couldn't understand that, okay?
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
You're listening to the Arman and Akil show on CITR 101.9 FM. So, Akil, I have heard you've started a new job. You're a sales guy. What's that like?
It's a lot of training, a lot of handshakes, a lot of phone calls, a lot of introductions, and a lot of lofty speech about how I am the person you want to be working with. And it's all true. Yeah. So if you're listening to this and you want to do business with me, hit me up.
That all sounds really good, Akil. But does it involve flying around in private jets?
I'm not at that level of sales yet, but that is the natural. That is not the natural next step, but there's one of the steps to follow, obviously.
I see. Well, somebody who is at that level is British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. He does a lot of flying around in private jets, and he's not super happy about you questioning him about it. So let's take a listen to that clip.
This I want to hear.
Just waiting for the ad to end.
Scotland, Ed. Should we just play the clip? Should we play the clip of him on Good Morning Scotland? Let's start there. Roll the clip.
Let me just ask you finally before you go, how are you getting up here to make this green announcement today? Private jet?
I'll be flying as I normally would, and that is the most efficient use of my time. But again, I think actually that question brings to life a great debate here. If you or others think that the answer to climate change is getting people to ban everything that they're doing to stop people flying, going on holiday, I mean, I think that's absolutely the wrong approach. Right, that's absolutely the wrong approach. I mean, every prime minister before me has also used planes to travel around the United Kingdom because it's an efficient use of time for the person running the country, so I can keep focusing on delivering for people. But if your approach to climate change is to say no one should go on holiday, no one should take on a plane, I think you are completely and utterly wrong.
Am I?
Right, that is absolutely not the approach to tackling climate
change.
There's
a difference between traveling
actually,
what we are doing is
investing in sustainable aviation fuel as one of the new technologies like carbon. carbon capture and storage will help us make the transition. It's not about banning flying. It's about investing in new technologies like sustainable aviation fuel that will make flying more sustainable. That's the right approach to this. But I look forward to having that conversation with you again. Well, Thanks very much for having me.
Yet another British Tory Prime Minister falling foul of a BBC regional radio station.
Yeah, so that was Rishi Sunak. What's your reaction to his?
Well, it's not surprising that almost billionaire Rishi Sunak, who traveled on private jets before he was prime minister, and will no doubt do the same after he stops being prime minister, is making the bad faith argument that. He's only doing it because he's prime minister, and prime ministers, of course, need to make efficient use of their time. That's very interesting. Then why, as a backbencher, were you also using private jets before you became prime minister? And why do you think it's – or I guess the point is, do you believe that that you and your billionaire buddies should be allowed to use private jets because – you've invested in sustainable aviation fuels, which may someday cause some reduction in the carbon emissions of flight.
Yeah, yeah, it's fascinating. It's also fascinating how he equates, you know, taking a private jet with taking any plane flight, with taking a holiday.
Exactly.
Because in his mind, taking a holiday means...
Inevitably,
you have to take a plane, and you need to take in a private jet.
Of course.
There's no distinction. Like, he's saying if you're banning private jets, that would mean banning holidays.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, the most ludicrous thing. And it just reveals, really, you know, the mentality of the elite people who run around in private jets. But, you know, just for context, France, which has the second number of private jet flights in Europe, announced a ban on short-haul private jet flights. And private jet usage has actually increased around 20% since 2019 levels. So we're actually doing it at a higher rate. And in the States, I don't know what the laws are around this in Canada and in the UK, but in the States, even though one in six flights handled by the FAA is a private jet flight, they contribute only 2% to the taxes funding it. While 70% is funded by, you know, regular passengers. And there are a lot of airports which only support private jet flights, and those are still fully funded by the public.
So the public's basically paying for airports that only support general aviation and no commercial aviation.
Yeah.
And yet the benefits almost exclusively are accrued by the ultra wealthy.
Yeah, so it's not just private jet is problematic. It's also being subsidized by everybody else.
Yeah.
So they're getting a bit of a discount on it, just to make you feel a bit better.
It's just a small discount where 70% is funded by the taxpayer, and you're only contributing 2%. To the coffer. But come on, if you ask them to contribute anymore, how are they going to buy that 14th yacht? And now they're going to look like they're the poor billionaires. You can't make people feel bad like that.
They need to make the efficient use of their time. They're not going out and watching Barbie movies.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. You know what they're doing? They're making Barbie movies up in the air in their private jets.
Exactly. Yeah. And they need that creative stimulation. Anyway, you can learn more about it. There's a great podcast about it on Today Explained. It's called Aristocracy. So I listened to a couple of days ago, and that's got my, you know, got me thinking more about this topic.
Moving away from private, actually, we have private jets here, but moving away from the air, something closer to home.
Maybe they're gonna have private jets soon.
Well, you know, so we're gonna hear next from Brenda Locke, the mayor of Surrey, regarding the Surrey Police Force, the Surrey Police Service, and the transition from the RCMP, which the city of Surrey currently employs contracts to for policing services, to their own police force. Maybe if they didn't make the transition, the mayor of Surrey could actually afford a private jet.
Or maybe as part of this transition, like the police force will just go around in private jets.
Exactly. Yeah.
Nabbing people.
Yeah. Vancouver Airport back to Boundary Bay.
Do you want me to just play the clip, or do you want to set it up a bit more first?
So in a nutshell, the context for this is for many years, Surrey has been discussing a transition to its own police force from the current model or the existing model of contracting to the RCMP. The first concrete steps were taken in 2020 with the establishment of the Surrey Police Board. And this board shortly thereafter established the Surrey Police Service. And this was a major issue in contesting the last mayoral election, with Mayor Locke winning on a platform of stopping and reversing the transition to the SPS and remaining with the RCMP. Let's hear what she has to... So that's broadly the context. Now, the Solicitor General for BC and the Minister of Public Safety, Mike Farnworth, has stepped in and used a provision under the Police Act to direct Surrey, basically ordering Surrey to continue with its transition and basically forcing them to continue with the transition.
Continuing transition means having their own police force.
Yes, basically from the RCMP to the Surrey Police Service. Now, in that, in the atmosphere of all of that going on, between the back and forth, this is Brenda Locke's response to Mike Farnworth's decision.
Wait for this lovely ad.
Policing in Surrey has taken another turn, with Mayor Brenda Locke calling BC Solicitor General a bully and a misogynist during a dramatic news conference on Monday.
I have worked in politics for a long time. I have worked in the liquor industry for a long time. I have never, ever used the gender card. But in this case, I absolutely think there is misogyny going on, no doubt in my mind.
The conference came hours after Mike Farnworth, the province's Solicitor General and Public Safety Minister, suggested the city was playing games, saying in a statement that despite multiple requests, his office still hadn't received the report council used when it voted to keep the RCMP over the Surrey Police Service last week. He added the city had until Monday afternoon to hand it over, or else he'll determine what's necessary for safe and effective policing without it.
What do you think, Roman?
Yeah, well, the thing I find, you know, most fascinating about it is that, you know, Mike Farnworth is basically claiming that, Brenda Locke, and the people running the Surrey City government are somewhat unreliable actors, but he still wants them to run their own police force.
Yeah,
rather than having the RCMP, so that's a bit of irony in there. We're like,
yeah,
you know, it's like forced autonomy is always it's generally the dynamic is reverse, where it's, you know, the umbrella one doesn't want, you know, cities or provinces going out doing their own thing. So that's the most interesting.
Well, but perhaps the fact that RCMP is not a provincial policing service, that's but true. It's a federal one, might have something to do with that.
Exactly, right. And that's another, you know, weird thing that we were discussing with Daniel Francis ways back, in terms of, you know, how did we end up with something like the RCMP?
Yeah, which is, I have not, in reading about policing around the world, I have not encountered anywhere where there's this level of integration between municipal policing and something like anti-terrorism work, right? Where you could, as Daniel Farnes has mentioned, you could end up with a situation where you're a police officer who works at an RCMP detachment in some hamlet somewhere early in your career, and somewhere midway through your career, you're now working on anti-terrorism, on an anti-terrorism task force in Canada. Yeah. It's a very interesting, substantial difference in the work that you're doing. They're both are important, but one is requires a different set of skills.
Yeah, yeah, it does. It's kind of more police state-y kind of vibe to have, you know, that kind of integration.
Yeah.
But which I think what you're alluding to. I think
so. Are you in favor of municipalities having their own police force or contracting out to the RCMP?
I haven't honestly read enough about this topic. I don't really have a strong. I agree with you. It's really weird that you have this integration. At the same time, you know, I don't know what's going on in Surrey. I don't know what their local politics are.
No,
like.
I mean generally, overall, just in general.
Yeah, in general, probably it's better to have their own police force.
Right.
But the specific case of Surrey, I'm not so sure what the situation's like. Yeah, we were going to take a break, but I don't think we have time for that.
Well, let's move right on to our next clip then.
Yeah, so, you know, it's getting really hot. You know, we have forest fires. We're hitting record temperatures. And, you know, there are different ways people are reacting to this. You know, some people are getting, you know, supports, like seniors are getting certain supports, getting advice, stay in the shade, wear a hat, keep hydrated, don't go out if it's hot. You get these emergency warnings.
Right.
You know, other people.
So one set of people are listening to the advisories and reacting in a natural way.
Yeah, and other people are, you know, firefighters and people are going out of their way. You know, scientists are trying to model the spread of these fires and trying to fight it. And then there's a third group of people who are flocking to Death Valley. Death Valley is the hottest place in the world. It's getting even hotter. And let's take a listen to why they're doing that. Yeah, just wait a moment.
So we're just loading the clip of
Death Valley. Can you talk a bit more about Death Valley in the meantime?
So this is often the hottest place on Earth in the summers. It is the lowest point in North America at a negative 280-something feet below sea level. I saw this photo of park rangers in all smiles at a temperature display in Death Valley when it was 56 degrees Celsius. I particularly liked one Redditor's take that it was like the dinosaurs posing in front of the asteroid and beaming with grins, because that's what it looked like. They were a little too happy that it was 56 degrees Celsius.
California folks aren't trying to beat the heat. They're actually flocking to it. Of course, we're talking about Death Valley, which decades ago set the record for the hottest place on Earth. Our Rob McMillan reports on how hot it can get there this time of year.
Death Valley National Park, home to the lowest point in all of North America, 282 feet below sea level. But it's also known for extreme heat this time of the year.
This heat here, 128 degrees, it's the real deal.
It's horrible.
I feel like I'm in an oven.
I don't even know what to think because you can't even think.
Well, try thinking about this. It's not just hot. On some days, it's been the hottest place on Earth.
The hottest temperature ever recorded was here in 1913, July 10th, 1913, and they recorded 134 degrees Fahrenheit.
Park Ranger Nico Ramirez says the unique geography here, with Death Valley so low and the Panamint Mountains on one side and the Black Mountains on the other, it only adds to the sizzling conditions.
The valley is so low, so that heat gets trapped. The sunlight hits down in the valley. The heat tries to escape at night, but it can't, and it gets forced back down, and it reheats kind of like a convection oven.
But if you think people are miserable here, perhaps it's self-inflicted torture. In the midst of a scorching summertime heat wave, people actually come here for the heat. And
so
for the
just
chance it's seeing another heat.
In this news report of people taking selfies with the kind of, they have a temperature dial out there.
Yeah. Basically, being tourists.
Very hot is okay for me.
Throughout the day at the Furnace Creek Visitor Center, people watched as the temperature rose steadily, 123 by noon, and as the afternoon wore on, 127, 128, 129.
The wind's blowing at a pretty good clip, and so it's almost scorching your skin.
10 minutes under the sun, I can stand, but not more than that.
According to the National Weather Service, the official heat record at Furnace Creek is 130.
Yesterday we hit 128, which was pretty close.
Alas, on this day, there would be no new world record set. But when it comes to extreme heat and breaking that 130 mark, is 129 really any different?
One place.
Yeah, so... Yeah, what's your take on what do you think is motivating people to experience
Until you introduced me to this phenomenon today, I didn't realize heat tourism was a real thing that people want to experience. I think, you know, if you're somebody who's experienced 40 degree weather, I think any reasonable person would just say that's more than enough. I wouldn't want to experience anything over that. But I think it's just novelty.
Yeah.
Right. You hear a lot about climate change in what to the layperson may be abstract terms, in numbers degrees of restriction by the end of the century. Say you want to restrict it to 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, 2.5 degrees of heating. And all of those are, if you are not a climate scientist or someone who is a statistician, someone who understands what the numbers signify, it can seem very abstract. So maybe you want to go there to experience what extreme heat is actually like. But that's not what climate change is going to do.
Yeah, I guess. It's just fascinating the choices people make in life.
I think it's just novelty, right? Yeah. I think you hear about extreme weather conditions and you want to experience it. And I think this is one of the almost safer
options, like instead of going to a hurricane tomorrow, you'll have people going visiting
to a hurricane or tornadoes. To wind up in the middle of a forest fire. I think that's a novel experience that I can do without.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I think 35 degree weather is too much. I have no intention of going somewhere where it's 20 degrees warmer than that, just for the novelty.
Yeah. So I think that brings us to the end of the show.
The music you heard in the intro is a brand new beat. It's called Goanese Cashew Drink. It was literally handcrafted for us by a close friend of the show, the magnificently capable and absolutely irreplaceable Sarah Pratt. You may be wondering what I meant by handcrafted music. I honestly have no idea. But you can listen to more of her on SoundCloud at the handle Leisure Noise. Couple other things to wrap up here. You can find us at The Armana Kill on Instagram and Twitter. Sorry, X. So check us out there.
On X. We do have more awesome shows and guests lined up for you. Do continue to listen and subscribe. You can find all of our episodes on our podcast feed, including interviews with City Councilor Christine Boyle and the historian Daniel Francis. Do check it out. Let's play some Song of the Mies to end things out.